tight. It had to be big. It had to be really big. But I was in Sydney, actually, when Arthur Cullen was shot. And we did that based on... there was no one out there with him. So we did it basically on police reports. And I think that happened about 10 o'clock at night. We didn't know about it till around about 11. And they stopped the press and we got it into the first edition. But that was another story. On a sitting day, it was a little bit different. On a sitting day, I'd come in again about 1 o'clock and we'd go and have lunch. 2 o'clock or 2:30. Parliament normally started at 2:30 in the afternoon on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, or at 10:30 on Thursdays, and it would sit until maybe 1 o'clock in the morning, wasn't it? The phrase legislation by exhaustion was frequently used, and particularly as you got towards the end of a session, they just sit and sit and sit. And so I was with AAP, so we just reported the gallery, and there was no going home for dinner or anything like that on sitting days. We used to we filled the wall of the office with quotes from the various with silly quotes from the various pollies. We had a bit of a competition among ourselves as to who could get the best quote. Can't remember them all. I think one was by, I think it was John Gorton, who said Australia is an island surrounded by water. And so it was things like that that we put up on the wall. After Parliament finished, we'd all sort of sit around and say, well, what was the silliest quote of the day? And scribble it down. And then we had a competition of reporting history as would have happened if AAP had been there. And so I think I won the prize with the Red Sea Life-Saving Club had its worst day in history today when several thousand Egyptian horsemen were caught by an unexpected wave and swept back into the sea. Those sorts of things. So there was a lot of fun. But we would have to sit there until the house finished. And of course on Wednesday nights it might not finish until 12:30, 1 o'clock. And you had to be back at 10:30 the next morning. And there were some occasions when they literally sat all night and we just had to stay here all night.
And you experienced that yourself?
Oh yeah. There was one time I did go home. I went home for dinner and I was so tired. I was eating, sitting at the table, and I went to sleep and my wife woke me up and my head had fallen into the mashed potato on the plate. And so she woke me up and I got in the car and came back in for a bit more. Because they'd sit, it wasn't unusual. It was unusual, but not uncommon for them to sit on a Friday and even into Saturday morning if they really wanted to get legislation through. And
How did that kind of work routine affect, you know, family life as a father and a husband?
Well, it put a lot of strain on my wife. Because she'd have the kids and then have to try and feed them and try and get my dinner ready for me when I'd come home, not knowing whether I was going to come home, because some nights you'd just have to ring and say, look, sorry, there's something happening and I just can't get home. So it did put a lot of strain there, and then I'd get home. I'd try to get home in time to bath them while she finished getting dinner ready, and maybe read a story if I could, maybe not. And it did impose those sorts of strains. On the other hand, not starting till 2 o'clock meant that you had the morning's free, so I can do a lot of work around the house and things like that. So, but it was harder on her than it would have been on me, I think.
And what about the access to areas in this building at that time?
Oh, it was totally wide open. About the only limitations were on the corridors that led down to on either side of the chambers. There would be an attendant standing at that, not even at every door, in fact, but there was usually at either the Senate side or the Rep side, there would be an attendant who could monitor both doors, because you'd just walk from one side of the building to the other through across King's Hall. King's Hall was the only public area, but there was really nothing to stop someone going. If you looked as though you owned the place, the attendants wouldn't stop you. There was no reason to. They might ask you, if they hadn't seen you before, they might ask, where are you going? And if you said, I'm going up to the press gallery, you know where it is? Yep, okay. I guess there probably was a little bit of a sixth sense they had about them, because I don't think there were ever any real incidents of problems. Maybe society was just different. There was a post office down where the security area is now, and anyone could go there. And as I said, King's Hall was just open for the general public to go to. And if people would come up to the press gallery, they'd come from departments, or there'd be lobbyists or various other people, they'd just walk in. And journalists, we had virtually total access through the building itself. The only area that was out of bounds was the corridor behind the House of Reps chamber, which led to the Prime Minister's office. And in fact, even that wasn't totally out of bounds, because the Press Secretary's office was just around the corner, and you had to go partly into that sort of no man's land to get to the press office. Beyond the press office, you could not go unless you were escorted by a press sec or one of the staff. But everywhere else, just wander around. In fact, one of the best ways to have a casual chat with a Polly was actually to go down to the men's toilets, which were on both sides in the members' areas. And as often as not, you'd find yourself taking a leak beside a cabinet minister. And because none of them had their own, well, with the exception of the very senior ones, none of them had their own bathrooms or anything like that. The only other area that was out of bounds was the members' dining room and the members' bar. But we could go anywhere. And the members had two dining rooms, a members' dining room, which was members only, and the other was the members' and members' guests' dining room, where a member could take family, friends, constituents, journos, if he wanted to.
And on occasions when you wouldn't go home for dinner, but you would eat here, where would you go to eat?
Oh, down at the non-members' dining room. Of which there was, as I said initially, there was that rather very formal boarding house type place. And then they opened up what we called the sheltered workshop, which was you can't get this on tape, but it was just sort of at the bottom of this courtyard. It was down over in the, it was virtually at the end of this this wing down on the ground floor. And it had a big open kitchen, cafeteria style, so it all line up in queues. And all these not terribly impressive cooks, I'm not sure you'd call them chefs, were putting steaks. The food wasn't all that bad, actually. In fact, the food was probably better in the sheltered workshop than it was in the proper, more formal dining room. Because you'd get steak, cold dishes, salads, baked roasts, and all sorts of things. So tucker wasn't bad. Sustaining anyway. Get yourself a little bottle of wine or a beer, either just eat by yourself or socialise with a few other people. A lot of gallery people just sort of sit down together, and with anyone who was there. So it was, I guess the thing about it was that everyone in the house just mixed in together. Every now and then a politician would go there, not very often. Usually if the pollies were going to eat, they'd eat in their own dining room or take you in to the guests' dining room.
And would they do that if they had an angle, like they wanted some kind of publicity?
Oh, basically, yes. Either you were courting them or they were courting you or both. Sometimes they'd go down to the non-members bar too. There was again, if there was a member who wanted to become better known to the gallery, they'd go down to the bar. Paul Keating used to go down there on occasion. George Georges used to go down there quite often. Peter Walsh, who was the finance minister, Peter probably spent more of his time down in the non-members dining room. A non-members bar, I should say, than he did in the members bar, and he was quite a sad figure. Actually, he was usually quite morose. Some said he'd had a bad childhood or difficulties with his mother or something like that, and he'd go down there, and I think he had more time for us than he had for his colleagues, which was understandable in many respects. Well, given that he was quite determined to be a model of fiscal virtue. I guess he was not more likely to be friendly with us than with his own colleagues. Trying to think who else frequented it. Come to me. But
can you tell me about the atmosphere in the non-members bar?
Well, it depended a bit on what time of day it was. Yeah. From memory, I don't think they opened first thing in the morning. I think they didn't open until about 12. I suppose like any bar, you'd get your regulars in there at that time who'd have a heart starter. One before lunch, and then after lunch, usually after question time, it was usually fairly empty. The barmen were, like most barmen, either gracious or very ungracious, depending on the time of day and their mood. The atmosphere, as the day wore on, the crowd got thicker, and it was smoky. I mean, everyone smoked in those days, so it was smoke-filled, stank of beer. The floor wasn't sticky in parts, but in parts it was. Jim Quirk, who was the Daily Mirror correspondent, had a habit of going down there from about 3 o'clock, he'd be a couple of sheets to the wind, and he used to delight in throwing a glass in the air, midi glass in the air, and sticking his foot out and either catching it with his heel, and or giving it a fair dinkum rugby kick. The glass would go up in the air, and it'd either shatter when he kicked it, or shatter when it hit the ground. So everyone knew that. When Jim was starting to get close to throwing the glass around, that it was time to move out of the bar for a little while. And then if it was a sitting day, of course, it would stay. It would become increasingly noisy. and people drank pretty hard in those days. There was, it was divided into two sections. There was a men's area and one where men and women could both go, and so a lot of the female staff and a lot of I suppose you'd say political groupies had gravitate to that bar. So again, the place, that's why I'm saying the movement around the place was pretty free and easy, because some of the women who would go there were not employed in Parliament House. They just go in there for a drink with the boys.
Okay.
And so it was... at the same time, I mean, it was, there were never any fights or anything like that there. It was a reasonably well-behaved place. I think probably as was usually the case with pretty well all drinking spots in those days, the noisiest time was when they were closing, and closing time could become a battle between the staff and the drinkers to see who gave in first. But
Journalists, like the stereotype of the journalists of that era, was that they had a drinking culture, you know, that they were they the main, was there a main section of the among the non-members who used the non-members bar, who were stalwarts of the bar?
Oh yes, there were some who drinking was done in two ways. One was in the members bar, and that was basically, as often as not, that was by the guys who were on afternoon newspapers. They'd finish work, so they'd just stay in the bar for a couple of hours to have a drink after work. And then there were those who would just go down for a quick drink in between jobs, or usually a drink between 4 and 4.30 if it was a quiet day, just before the bar closed. There were the guys like Jim who would be regulars in there. In many cases, as well as that, everyone had a fridge in their office, a little, usually an old fridge. And most of the time, you'd go down there and get two dozen cans, take them back, and people would have a drink in the office while they were working. So, these days, I guess it was a pretty alcohol-fueled environment. At the same time, I don't think there was a lot of drunkenness as such. There weren't people falling down drunk. Everyone was able to. No one ever drank to the point where they were incapable of functioning. I suppose that probably owes more to the impression than the fact. Other people may have had quite a different view.
Yeah. You mentioned that there was a men's section and then a section for men and women.
Yeah.
Does that mean that women were excluded from the men's section?
For quite a few years, yes. I don't know whether they were actually excluded sort of by law. Not that there was any law here. But they were... Women did not go into the non-members bar. They went into... I forget what they called it. I don't think they... They may have called it the lounge. But, of course... That was true of anywhere. I mean, any drinking establishment in those days, women were segregated from the sort of public bar. I vividly remember my wife and I went down to Tasmania in about 1970s, about 76, 77, and we went to a little pub in one of the country towns, and I walked into the bar with her. There were two barmaids behind the bar, and about 10 men in there, and the barmaids were horrified that a woman had come into the bar. They were more concerned about it than the blokes were, actually, but so she was told, quite in no uncertain terms that the ladies' lounge was around the corner. And I suppose the same sort of thing probably would have happened here up until up until probably the early to mid-70s. And then there was some redesign done, and for some reason I think the ladies' lounge disappeared, and women did go into, then the non-members bar became open to everyone, and so there were then women and men both having a drink together, as they did outside.
Yeah. Was the non-members bar important politically?
Not totally. I don't think so. I mean, it would be a time. It would be in a couple of senses, I suppose. To the extent that there was a groupthink among the gallery, that's the place where it would take place. You know, that's where the conspiracy theories or the all that sort of thing would begin to develop. But there wasn't a lot of that taking place in those days. A politician who didn't want to be seen taking it to the members' guests' dining room would go, if he wanted to have a drink, to go down to the bar. But that was usually as much to be seen as anything else. So it was rather paradoxical that you'd go to a very... Well, in fact, that's the reason why it was such a public place, that you could exchange confidences there. Of course, no one had believed that anyone would be silly enough to go and leak in a place as public as the non-members bar, because everyone knew that, let's say Peter Walsh, everyone would know Peter Walsh was in there talking to the journalists. So Peter wouldn't have been so stupid as to tell him anything that had happened in caucus or cabinet. Yet it was also very convenient. Therefore, again, paradoxically, it was a good place for them to leak because it was so obvious. Now, I'm using leak in the sense of provide you with confidence information rather than... I was never conscious of a very much of that sort of groupthink, which I think started to flow into the gallery in later years. I think there's probably a lot more. I don't know whether you've ever seen a film called Flying High. But
yeah, the comedy.
Yeah. Well, you remember in that there's a press room or a group of journalists who are reporting on the what's going on in the skies, they rush over to one end because something's happened there, and then they rush over to the other end because they've told something's happening here. Well, I reckon that's how the gallery has now become. Of all these people, just rush to one side because that's where the story is, and then rush back to the other side. There was probably, I don't know whether there was more competition, but there were probably people tended to pursue their own contacts and stories. I mean, there were big stories which everyone was after. When I came down here, it was the F-111 purchase. It was Vietnam. The other issues were fairly peripheral, quite frankly. And that's why I got health and social services. And the other thing I became interested in was the Senate, because everyone regarded the Senate in those days as being an old men's club, which to some extent it was. No one was particularly interested in spending much time there, or the Senate was just sort of a rubber stamp. However, the Senate became increasingly unstable. The Democratic Labor Party had four and ended up with five senators. Lionel Murphy had come in and become the leader of the government, leader of the opposition in the Senate. Lionel was a very ambitious man. He was from the left. And I always thought that deep down he harboured an ambition to move from the Senate to the House of Reps and take on Whitlam as leader. I might have been wrong about that, because he never said it in so many words, but one got the impression he was. And Lionel had decided that the Senate could be used as a fairly effective political weapon. Up until that time, it was basically comprised of trade union officials, or one might cruelly say trade union hacks, and ex-Liberal Party office holders. Gradually that was changing, and there were younger people coming in from on both sides who didn't have the same sort of affiliations and as the others, and they were ambitious, and they wanted, being parliamentarians, they didn't want to just sit in the Senate and make dull, boring speeches and rubber stamp legislation coming from downstairs. And because the DLP did have the balance of power, the Senate started to become a more interesting place, because it was always possible that if Labor and the DLP voted together, government legislation could be stopped. It very rarely happened. It usually took its form more in the case of them joining together to establish inquiries. And Murphy used it quite definitely, as I said, as a political weapon to get inquiries held, which would provide Labor with ammunition to undermine the then government. So, whereas before it had been a backwater, it started to become a place where things could happen. And I was one of the only people who'd taken enough interest in the Senate to actually know the senators and what was going on. I got to know Jim Hodges, who was the clerk of the Senate and who wrote Rogers' Senate Practice quite well. And Jim, again, was very determined to make the Senate a significant institution. Peter Ray from Tasmania, again, very ambitious and again determined to make something of his career. Magnus Cormack, who looked like if you put a toga on him, he would have looked like a Roman senator. You know, he would have been totally at home in Rome. Had a big white hair and a craggy face. And he ended up becoming president of the Senate. There's one story I've just thought. This is not reported in Hansard, one of the few things that have been excised from Hansard. But one day towards the end of a session, Magnus was not the president at that stage. He was just an ordinary senator. Sir Alastair McMullen was the president of the Senate. And looking down from the Senate gallery, one always saw that Sir Alastair's glass of water had bubbles in it. And there was a distinct odour of gin emanating from him. So he was having a gin and tonic while he was presiding. Anyway, at question time, Senator George Poyser from Labor Victoria rose to his feet and said, "Mr. President, my question is directed at you. Are you aware that the state of Victoria has recently introduced a device called the breathalyzer, which is used to establish the alcohol level of drivers? Would you arrange for one of these devices to be installed in the Senate, at the entrance to the Senate chamber, so that the sobriety of Senator Cormack may be tested each evening after dinner?" Well, Magnus leapt to his feet. "Oh, Mr. President!" McMullen's going, "Order, order, order." And without any hesitation, Poyser was kicked out. So I thought this
was... And that wasn't in the Hansard. The
Hansard just says, "Disorderly question." Uh-huh. That's all the Hansard records. So I went down, and in those days, we would often move from the gallery down into the King's Hall to serve. If we wanted to ask a senator a question, catch him on the way out. So I got down there, and Poyser was standing out there at the last, giggling to himself. And I said, "Just can you tell me, why did you ask that question?" And he said, "Well, son," he said, "I've been in the Senate for X number of years, And in all that time, I've never been kicked out. This is my last term. I don't want to stay here for the next couple of days, so I thought I'd give myself an early mark and give that old so-and-so a payback.
Oh boy. You mentioned that you'd wait in King's Hall to...
Yeah.
Would many journalists do that?
Not a lot. I guess different people had their different places where they'd operate from. Alan Reid used the Magna Carta. That was basically his office. And the Magna Carta or I think the Constitution. And they were both in big glass. I don't know whether they're still there. I imagine they are in big glass cabinets. Alan would just loiter, or not loiter, he would just lean on the glass case, which was on the direct route from the House of Reps opposition side to the Senate government side. And you could see from there, you could see down to the front of the house, which was the where the government party room was and the opposition caucus room on the Senate side. So you could, from that position, you could see anyone moving from one part of the building to the other. And because of the way the place is constructed, as I said, you've got the government party room on the front of the building and the government Senate party room on the other side of the building. So if a government minister wanted to go over to the government side of the Senate, he'd have to walk diagonally across King's Hall, which meant going past Magna Carta or the other one. And so Alan would wait there, and people would walk past and they'd say, "Oh, g'day Alan, how are you?" And walk over for a chat. And as I said about the non-members bar, it was such a public place that no one could be accused of leaking confidential information, because you would not do that in a public place like that. You wouldn't. If people saw you talking to Alan Reid, they would know that you weren't telling him something that he shouldn't know. So he'd pick up a lot of information there. Others, I guess, I don't know, sort of probably in fact posted themselves in sort of strategic positions around King's Hall. I particularly remember that because working for Alan, that's where I'd often go and spend some time talking to him while he was waiting for someone to come out. And of course, as soon as someone came out, he'd just brush me off and talk to them. But if you were in the gallery and you wanted to clarify something or get someone to amplify something they'd said, you'd go down to the front door of the chamber and get an attendant to go in there and ask the member to come out. Which they do, and they then amplify whatever it was that you wanted them to. That was, Alan had a chair in the office. He had a lounge chair, which had been appropriated with the help of the attendants. In fact, virtually every press gallery office had they'd replaced the chairs in the chamber, and as they did that, they had to put them somewhere, so they furnished the gallery. I don't know whether you know this, and I don't know whether it's still the case now. The gallery existed and probably still does on sufferance. It has the journos have no right to be in Parliament House. Unless they've changed the rules, it is still exactly the same as it was in England years and years and years, centuries ago, where any member can at any time rise in their place and call the attention of the presiding officer to the fact that there is a stranger in the house. And if there's a stranger in the house, everyone's out except the members. And that was done, I think it was done once in my time. I spy a stranger. But I can't remember. I cannot for the life of me remember the outworkings of it. But in any event, the gallery has no right, journalists have no right to be here. And in the days when a bloke called Archie Cameron was Speaker of the House, the question was raised as to whether the press gallery proprietors should be required to pay rent for the space that they're occupying, free of charge. And the furnishing, all the furnishing was provided by Parliament House too. And Archie, who didn't like the gallery at all, he'd frequently apparently walk around the gallery checking out what was there, what had been stolen by the journalists from downstairs, and which included things like Parliament House glasses, which had very nice Glimpost Parliament House things on them. Very good souvenirs. And Archie said no, he would not, they would not be charged rent, because if they paid rent, they would have tenants' rights. And he always wanted to be in a position, and I think successive speakers also have, of being able to just throw the gallery out if it suited them to do so. Alan had in his room one of those big lounges, and it was next to his desk, and mostly any member who wanted to talk to him, really secretly, but without being too obvious, would come to our office, sit down beside Alan's chair.